Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.
Great to be back.
Today we're looking into the story of Dimdim Castle, Kale Dimdim in Kurdish. We've got some really interesting material you shared, historical accounts, you know, Safavid chronicles, but also powerful cultural stuff like the Beti Dimdim epic, and even some modern takes.
Yeah, quite a mix.
So our aim is to explore the history, understand its significance, and sort of see how this place lives on in memory. All based just on these sources you provided.
Exactly. And Dimdim isn't just, you know, a pile of old stones.
No, definitely not. It sits right atop Mount Dimdim, west of Lake Urmia in Iran's West Azerbaijan province. Super strategic spot.
Its location alone tells you something. Overlooking those routes, it was always going to be important.
But as these sources really show, Dimdim is... well, it's become this incredible, powerful symbol, especially for Kurdish identity.
Absolutely. And right from the start, even figuring out its origins shows you how layered this history is. The sources give a few possibilities, don't they?
They do. There's Kurdish oral tradition suggesting it might be really old, pre-Islamic even. Maybe an earlier Fort Damdam that crumbled.
Right, that's one strand. Then you've got an Arabic source pointing to maybe the 12th century, built for local emirs needing a stronghold there.
And that modern Persian news report you sent in makes a pretty big claim, calls it a 3,000-year-old military castle.
Yeah, that number jumps out, connects it way back. But the sources are right to say, you know, that needs a closer look. We need to be careful with that one.
Definitely. So amidst all that, the most solid historical point, the one the sources really focus on, is the reconstruction in 1609.
Exactly. Emir Zanlepsaren, the Bradost Kurdish ruler, he rebuilt what the sources call a ruined structure right on that key spot. That's the event that really kicks things off.
And there's that detail in some sources that sort of complicates things from the get-go. The idea he might have actually asked Shah Abbas Ido for permission.
That's in there. Reportedly saying he needed a secure place for his family, his property, maybe pointing to an old ruin near Urmia as, like, justification.
What's interesting there is how that could change the perspective, couldn't it? If he did have initial permission, maybe it wasn't outright rebellion from day one.
It suggests, perhaps, that the conflict grew later. Maybe differing ideas about how much autonomy he really had versus, you know, the Shah's central control.
But either way, deciding to build up that fortress on Mount Dimdim, that was a statement. A political move by Emir Zan.
No question. And according to Iskander Beg Turkoman, the Safavid historian writing in the 17th century, this wasn't just some minor fort he rebuilt.
Right. His description sounds pretty impressive.
It does. He describes it as a really formidable, not just one building, but a complex of five separate forts. And it had protected water reservoirs, places to store ice and snow.
Wow. So quite sophisticated. Prepared for the long haul.
Definitely indicates they were building something for a serious defense, showing the Bradost Emirate meant business.
Which brings us right to Emir Zanlepsaren himself, the Golden Hand Khan. What do the sources tell us about his motivations?
Well, fundamentally, it seems he wanted to secure his principality, the Bradost area. Assert its independence, really.
It was a tough neighborhood, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Caught between empires.
Exactly. Ottoman and Safavid empires constantly fighting over that region. So building up Dimdim was a very concrete way for him to try and carve out his own space, his own power, in all that chaos.
And then there's that really colorful backstory some sources mention.
Oh, yeah, the Golden Hand story. That he might have started as a stable boy for Shah Abbas himself.
Rose through loyalty, lost a hand fighting the Russians for the Safavids, and the Shah gives him a golden prosthetic. Lepsaren.
If that's true, and it's a compelling story, it adds this whole personal dimension, doesn't it?
Hugely. Because from Shah Abbas's point of view, if this guy owed his position, maybe even his golden hand, to him.
Then Emir Zan setting himself up independently at Dimdim would feel like a massive betrayal. Personal, not just political.
Which could definitely explain the intensity of the conflict that followed. The harshness of the response.
It certainly could have poured fuel on the fire.
Okay, so that really sets the scene for the main event. The Battle of Dimdim, or the siege, really, 1609 to 1610. What's the wider picture then?
Well, it's Shah Abbas III's reign. He's all about centralizing Safavid power, cracking down on local rulers, Kurdish tribes included, who weren't falling into line.
And the Ottoman War is still going on.
Yes. So securing that western border region where Dimdim sits was critical for him. He clearly decided direct control over Bradost was necessary. No more local autonomy there.
And the siege itself, the sources say it was a major military operation.
Oh, absolutely. A big Safavid army led by the Grand Vizier, Hatem Beg Ordubadi. The defenders under Emir Zan were definitely facing long odds, outnumbered, less advanced weaponry.
But they put up a hell of a fight.
Remarkable resistance. The siege dragged on for what, almost a whole year? November 1609 to the summer of 1610.
That long. That alone tells you something about the defenses and the people inside.
It really does. And you get these dramatic details from the narrative traditions, like in Arif Shama's novel, which pulls from that folklore.
What kinds of details?
Well, the idea that when defeat seems certain, maybe the water ran out, Emir Zan and the last defenders chose destruction over surrender, blowing up the castle themselves.
A final act of defiance.
Oh.
Wow. Which leads to the aftermath. And it sounds grim.
The sources describe it as brutal. Summer 1610, the Safavids finally breached the walls. And according to those Safavid chronicles, it was a total massacre of the defenders.
And it didn't stop at the castle walls.
No. Iskandar Beg Turkoman writes that Shah Abbas ordered wider reprisals, a general massacre across the Braidost and neighboring Mukrian regions. Punitive action on a large scale.
And then came the demographic engineering.
Yes, a very calculated long-term strategy described in the sources. Forcibly deporting many Kurdish tribes from the area, shipping them off to Khorasan way in the northeast.
And bringing others in.
Mm-hmm. Settling loyal Turkic Afshar tribes around Urmia instead. The goals seem clear. Break local Kurdish power, dilute the population, and ensure future control by bringing in people loyal to the central state.
And this, right here, is where that theme of contested history just explodes, isn't it? Two completely different ways of telling the same event.
Absolutely. It's stark in the sources. On one side, the Safavid view, mainly from Iskandar Beg Turkoman's official history, the Tariki Alamari Abbasi.
How does he frame it?
As putting down a rebellion. Simple as that. Emir Zan is portrayed as illegitimate, treasonous, arrogant, vapors of conceit and pride is a phrase used, driven by selfish ambition for independence.
So the violence was justified as restoring order.
Exactly. It legitimizes the whole campaign, the siege, the massacres, the deportations, as necessary state action against a disloyal subject.
Okay. And then the other side, the Kurdish account.
Almost the complete opposite. Preserved mainly in that epic poem, the Beiti Dimdim, and in oral traditions passed down by storytellers and then later picked up in literature.
And their story is?
Heroic resistance. A struggle against foreign oppression, against an empire trying to crush them. The Beiti Dimdim isn't just a poem, it's seen as a national epic.
Calling the defenders martyrs.
Yes, using the word shahid. Fighting for their land, their dignity. This is where you get those really potent images, women choosing death over capture, the final decision to blow up the castle.
So it turns a military defeat into something else entirely.
Into a moral victory. A story of unbreakable spirit. It preserves memory, shapes identity, you know, keeps the flame alive.
So it really boils down to the victors writing the official history.
Versus a counter-narrative kept alive through culture by those who lost on the battlefield but refused to let their story die.
The Safavid version justifies power.
Right. While the Kurdish cultural forms the epic, the stories become tools for survival, for asserting identity against that power. It's a fight over meaning, really.
And even that earlier point about Emir Zan maybe getting permission initially.
It just reinforces that it wasn't necessarily black and white from the start. It likely spiraled out of control based on differing views of that relationship, that fundamental clash between empire and local autonomy.
It's fascinating, too, that the Beiti Dimdim spread so widely. Gurmanji, Sarani versions, even Armenian versions mentioned.
Yeah, that reach is telling. It suggests the story struck a chord beyond just the Brados Kurds. It became a wider regional symbol of defiance against overwhelming imperial power.
Shows how stories of resistance can travel, right?
Definitely find resonance across different groups facing similar pressures.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Roj Bosh.
Roj Bosh.
How's the chai today, Hannah? Is it good? Ooh, smells lovely.
Let me try. Ah, that hits the spot. Perfect balance today, I think. Not too bitter.
No, it's really smooth. Just the right sweetness for me. Fantastic. Thanks, Anna.
Excellent.
Okay, always good to pause for chai. Right, where were we? Dimdim's legacy.
Indeed. So we've seen the history, the clash of narratives. Now, how has this story actually survived and stayed relevant? The Beiti Dimdim you mentioned is key.
A pillar of Kurdish oral tradition carried by the Deng Beyes.
Exactly. Those traditional bards, the storytellers. Absolutely crucial. They weren't just reciting. They were embedding the story in the culture, making it a living memory passed down generation after generation.
But it wasn't just oral history forever. It got written down, too.
It did. The sources point to Fakih Terhan, a 17th century Kurdish poet, apparently the first known written version, a poetic account.
So quite soon after the events.
Relatively, yeah. He likely drew on those oral stories that were already circulating, but helped, you know, solidify it in written form, gave it another kind of permanence.
And that literary tradition continues right into modern times. Several writers revisited it.
Yes, the sources highlight Soviet Kurdish writers like Arab Shamilov. His novel Dim Dim was apparently quite influential, even got translated into Italian. And others like Haji Jundi or Dikan Jalil.
They adapted the story into modern novels.
Mm-hmm. Bringing it to new audiences using modern literary techniques.
And contemporary authors are still engaging with it, too.
Absolutely. Jan Dost's Kila Dimdime is mentioned as important for bringing these historical narratives back into focus, really helping to build that sense of national consciousness through story. And Yasin Mahmoud Aziz's Dum Dum Castle in English, explicitly drawing on history and oral tradition to make it accessible internationally.
So this isn't just a dusty old tale. It's constantly being retold, reimagined.
It really is. It shows this ongoing conscious effort within Kurdish culture to keep these foundational stories alive, this heritageization, as some call it, especially vital when you don't have a state doing that official history work for you. These revivals keep the story meaningful.
And that comparison made in the sources between Beti Dimdim and Memuzin, seeing them as complementary.
That's a really insightful point. Not about which is better, but how they maybe represent different facets of Kurdish experience or identity.
So if Memuzin is about love, destiny, maybe national yearning,
then Dimdim is the story of collective struggle. Resistance against oppression, fighting for autonomy and dignity against the odds. Two sides of the same cultural coin, perhaps. Providing different but equally crucial foundations.
Which leads perfectly into Dimdim's symbolic power today. Why does it still resonate so strongly?
I think because it taps into so many core themes. Identity, resilience, national feeling, resistance. The sources flat out call it a symbol of steadfastness. Emir Zan and the defenders aren't just history, they're revered figures. Commemorated.
And you linked this symbolic weight earlier to the situation of statelessness.
Yes, I think that's key. When you don't have a state apparatus to define and promote your national history, sites like Dimdim, events like the siege, narratives like the Beti, they become incredibly important. They carry the weight of identity, of historical memory, they're rallying points, symbols against assimilation.
And it's not just academic discussion. The sources show it's actively used in modern Kurdish life, even politics.
That's where it gets really striking, yeah. That example from Sur, during the fighting in 2015-16, a fighter's diary saying, "Let Sur be the fortress Dimdim."
Wow. That's incredibly direct. Using history as a blueprint for the present.
Exactly. Political leaders reference it too. It's what you might call a usable past.
A past drawn on for current struggles.
Precisely. And culturally, there's that idea mentioned in the sources linking resistance to storytelling itself. The notion that there's no defeat as far as there are words to create the story.
Resilience through narrative.
Hmm? And the martyr aspect we touched on earlier is part of its power, too.
Those traumatic endings, choosing death, destroying the castle.
In some tellings, yeah. It's not just about loss. It's framed as ultimate commitment, a moral or spiritual triumph over military defeat. Whatever the precise historical facts, culturally, that narrative is designed to inspire, to mobilize.
And the story reaching international audiences through translation and study.
That definitely helps raise broader awareness of this part of Kurdish history and culture beyond Kurdish circles themselves.
Yeah. So finally, what about the castle itself? Dimdim today. What do the sources say it's like?
Well, they describe it mostly as ruins. Accessible to the public, though. You can still see parts of the wall, some stone and brick structures. It's near a place called Gili Kazmlu.
But detailed information like recent archaeology, lots of photos, seems a bit sparse.
That's something the sources note, yeah. Despite its importance, there isn't a wealth of easily accessible, detailed, up-to-date info out there. Remember that Persian news report calling it 3,000 years old?
Yeah.
It mentioned cultural heritage approval, but then a reader comment right below it disputed the location. Shows local interest, but maybe also some confusion or lack of clear official info.
What might that lack of readily available detail suggest?
Well, based on the sources, one interpretation could be that maybe it's not a top priority for major state-funded research or preservation. Sometimes sites strongly tied to minority narratives. While they might not get the same level of official attention or resources as sites that fit more neatly into the dominant national story.
Although it is recognized in Iran's heritage system, right? It's on lists of castles.
Yes, it's definitely acknowledged. And being publicly accessible suggests it's, you know, a complex situation. Maybe some tolerance. Maybe it's too significant to ignore. Maybe there are efforts to frame it in a broader, less specific way.
But clearly, given the history, the different origin stories, more research seems vital.
Absolutely. Archaeological work could potentially shed light on those earlier periods, and preservation is obviously crucial.
And that local interest, even if it's just a comment correcting a location, that's valuable too.
For sure. It shows a living connection. That could be harnessed for preservation efforts if it's engaged with properly.
So, summing it all up, Dindim Castle really feels like a microcosm, doesn't it? History, memory, identity, all packed into one site.
It really does. It perfectly captures that clash between the official Safavid story of rebellion and the Kurdish narrative of resistance. Highlights how history itself is contested territory, a struggle over meaning.
And the Beiti Dimdim, the literature. Absolutely central to keeping that counter-narrative alive.
Preserving it, reshaping it, making sure it continues to resonate in Kurdish culture and thought. Dimdim is so much more than ruins. Its story is alive, it's dynamic, it offers resilience, a sense of agency for people working to maintain who they are.
A powerful testament to how the past is never really past. It's interpreted, it's used, it shapes the present.
You know, what really stands out from all the source material for me is thinking about how one single event, seen through such different eyes, recorded in state records versus sung in epics, can essentially become two separate truths.
Yeah.
And each of those truths is deeply important for the identity, the self-understanding of the groups involved, even centuries later. What does that tell you, really, about how history works and how memory functions?